Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That's kind of conversation between your soul. That's conversation between your soul and the night.
American Prestige listeners, it's Derek. I'm joined as always by my friend and comrade Danny Bessner, and we are very lucky to welcome to the program today Abigail Mullen. She is an assistant professor at the U.S. Naval Academy. More importantly, for our purposes, she is the author of a new book, To Fix a National Character, The United States in the First Barbary War, 1800 to 1805. She has also contributed to a board game about the Barbary War, which we may get a chance to ask her about, The Shore of Tripoli, that was published by Fort Circle Games. So we may come back to that toward the end of the interview. But Abby, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start basically with what drew you to the First Barbary War and what you found when you started researching it in terms of what wasn't there, what you aimed to fill in doing this project.
Sure. So I think my interest in the war actually goes back quite a long way. I first learned about it in eighth grade, actually, but I sort of kept coming back to it over the course of my high school, college, and then even sort of early graduate school career. And I don't really know exactly what drew me to this subject, except that it just felt like such a compelling story. And yet I would read sources and think, that's not really how I've seen the story told in the past. So that sparked an interest to think about, well, what is missing from this story? How can we explain this war, which feels kind of ridiculous in some ways, and the rhetoric that you see in popular culture or in newspapers or magazines or whatever, if you ever encounter this war, it's often this very triumphalist story about how the United States took it to Tripoli and beat the pants off of them. And I was reading things and I was like, that is not what happened here.
Yeah, that's really not it, but yeah, okay.
So, you
sure,
know,
let's go with that.
And particularly in the years after 9/11, there was a raft of books that came out that are like America's First Brush with Jihad and Thomas Jefferson giving the Bashaw of Tripoli a spanking. And like, I just read those and I thought, that's totally wrong. So, and I'll tell you,
First Brush with Jihad is perfect, so good, right? Perfect war on
terror. Is that a real title or is that like an argument? Because that's pretty wild. Oh, God, I'd love to revisit those post 9/11 books. Jesus Christ, I bet you they aged like fine wine.
No, there is one that's called, I can't think of the title, but Jihad is in either the title or the subtitle. Yeah. I just sort of wanted to do something with that because I was like, this cannot be the actual story here. So what's really going on in this war? And then as I started to read more in the sources, I learned that actually this is a really, really complex war. And it sounds very simple in the sort of one paragraph way that people talk about it, but it's really complicated. And there's a lot of things going on that set the tone for American foreign policy and for the way that the Navy works. And then about two semesters about before I finished my dissertation, which is the origin of this book, there was a New York Times bestseller that was written called Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates. And I read that book and I thought, well, there's good news for me, which is that there's more to say about this topic than what is in that book. So I still have something to contribute here. And that's how, yeah, that's how it came to be.
Before we get into the war, which we'll talk about for folks who are not necessarily familiar with it or who may actually believe that this was America's first brush with jihad. When you talk about the sources, what kinds of things were you looking at as you put together the project?
That's a great question. So anybody who studies the First Barbary War starts with this 6-volume documentary collection that was put together by the Secretary of the Navy in the 1940s. It is magnificent. Honestly, I cannot tell you the number of times I went to an archive, looked at sources in the archive, and then I went home and I looked and those documents were already in the document collection. So that's the starting place for any work on the First Barbary War. And so there's a lot of stuff. Most of the Navy stuff is in there. Where I branched out a little bit from the traditional straight up Navy telling of the story is in really emphasizing and taking seriously the consular records. So there are a bunch of consular dispatches from each of the consuls in each of the Barbary states, but also consuls all around the Mediterranean. And they have a lot to say. Some of them have more to say than the Navy guys. So I spent a lot of time looking at consular records. And then, of course, you have the more far-flung sources. I don't speak Arabic, which is probably bad. I don't speak Turkish, but the British were in the Mediterranean as well. So you can look at British sources to see what the British think about the United States. You can find English language sources written by people who are in one of the Italian states. So I tried to really make sure that I was looking for sources that told more than just a straight up operational naval history of the war.
So why don't we actually turn a little bit to the war, and maybe you could give a sense of American geopolitics at the turn of the 18th into the 19th century. It was a very different country. I teach my students about the First Barbary War, and I ask them if any of them know the Marine Song, and none of them really do anymore. At some point they do. But what is actually going on? Because famously, I actually just did a panel in DC yesterday, and someone was bringing up the famous foreign entanglements quote, which is actually not a quote. He actually doesn't ever use the phrase foreign entanglements. It's a two-line thing, and he uses the word entangle and foreign. But anyway, so what is American foreign policy in this early, early moment in the history of the Republic, and how does what's going on in Northern Africa relate to that?
Yeah, I talk about this a lot, not just in the context of this book, but I used to have a podcast called The Consolation Prize, which was about the U.S. consular service. And we talked a lot there and in the book about how the idea of no entangling alliances and sort of the Washington farewell address, that's all lovely. But when he gave that address, the United States already had plenty of foreign entangling connections, not alliances in the technical sense of the term. There were no papers signed. There was no like head of state to head of state meeting. But the United States was already wrapped up in other places in the world by the time Washington is leaving office. And then we have the Adams administration, where we have a huge problem with France, and which started in the Washington administration as well. But during the Adams administration, the Navy gets built because of problems with the Barbary states, and then it gets used first actually against France because of all the alliances that were left over from the Revolution. So because the United States did already have this entangling alliance with France and then wanted to break the agreement. So there's, from the United States perspective, there's already a sense that the United States wants to move out into the world commercially. And that's going to drive foreign policy for the entire 19th century, is where do they want to go so that they can trade? This is happening everywhere from China. First American ship to China goes in 1784, to the Mediterranean, to the Caribbean, all the places that they couldn't access as subjects of the British Empire. So commerce is the thing that drives American foreign policy. because if you're going to send your ship somewhere and they're going to get captured, or your citizens are not going to be safe, well, that's not going to work. So everything that the government is doing to try to establish connections with other nations is all in service of commerce. However, there's a wrinkle, and that is the United States is not the only one doing things in the world. It turns out there's actually a big old conflict going on in Europe and across the world that the United States is attempting to studiously stay out of, but they can't really avoid it. And that is the French Revolutionary Wars and then folding into the Napoleonic Wars. That is a world-altering cataclysmic event. And the United States has to deal with it however they're going to. And they pick a few different ways to deal with it, and they end up in bad situations, like the quasi-war with France, which is directly related to the French Revolutionary Wars. And even a lot of stuff that goes on in the First Barbary War has more to do with the Napoleonic Wars than it has to do with Tripoli at all. So the United States is grappling with how to be a tiny little player on the world stage while this huge, huge conflict is going on. And it's a real challenge for them.
What is the theory of the commercial republic?
I don't know. What is the theory of the commercial republic?
So when I teach my students about this, I talk a lot about how this early notion of the United States as being a commercial republic, and that it would use trade basically as a means to tamp down violence on the international stage, or at least not bring violence to the United States. So I'm just curious, what are they doing with, like, what is the idea that, is it just that they want to trade? Is there a larger theory into which this focus on trade fits?
I don't think they thought of it as being a larger ideological idea. Not well, I can't say that for sure, actually, but there certainly are people who see commerce as being ideological. But also, you have to remember that this is just their moment to go out and trade wherever they want. And so the people who are actually doing the trading, they may have an ideological bent that they think that it's good for a republic to be able to do that. But also, they're just happy they don't have to only trade within the British Empire anymore, which means they can make more money. That's why they're going to the Mediterranean. It's not because they have any particular ideological reason. It's because they can make money in the Mediterranean. So are there people, certainly in government, who are talking about trade as being an important part of Republican ideology? Yeah, absolutely. But on the ground, or rather on the ocean, it's more about the money than anything else, I think, personally. But
no,
I'm not an intellectual historian, so I think there's certainly something to be said. But I think I'm very much about the, like, why do people actually do the things they do? And most of the time it's not because they have some sort of highfalutin idea. It's because they want to make money, or they want to provide for their family. So that's what they're trying to do.
No, for sure. I tend to agree. So who is doing the trading?
It's a mix of people. So there's, as you might expect, there's lots of movement in and out of New England because that's where the shipbuilding is going on. A lot of shipbuilding is going on, but also the middle states are doing a lot of trading. Merchants who were merchants even under the British system are still doing it, or by this point, it's probably their sons or their family is doing it. But it's, you know, people who live in coastal communities who have the opportunity to either own a ship or work on a ship. And it's trading things like fish, like dried fish or pickled fish, so cod, mostly from New England, things like wheat. And then they're going into the Mediterranean to get things like olive oil and wine and stuff like that. So it's sort of a mix. There's not really one thing that's moving in and out of the Mediterranean.
So maybe let's talk a little bit about the conflict. You were relating it to the French Revolution. So we've talked a little bit about the Revolutionary Wars and the Napoleonic Wars, but what is precisely going on in Europe during this period, and how does the United States fit into that larger geopolitical frame? And I think it's one thing that I always try to imbue to my students is that the U.S. is really the periphery at this point. Obviously, you know, they're Americans, or at least living here, and they have usually U.S.-centered vision of the world, but it's very much not the case. So maybe you could talk a little bit about Europe and then how that relates to the United States.
Sure. And I think your point is absolutely spot on, that Americans, even in 1801, see themselves as the center of the universe, and yet they are literally the only people in the world that think that. So no one else is looking at the United States and being like, oh man, they're going to be a real threat someday. Nobody's doing that. So the two big powers are Britain and France, and they're pretty busy fighting each other, which works out okay for the United States sometimes, because you can actually take advantage of a conflict like that, especially if you're trading and you can be a neutral. But in the Mediterranean in particular, all the other places are being caught up in this conflict. So the alliances actually shift over the course, even of the war, the First Barbary War, the Revolutionary and Napoleonic alliances are shifting during the war. But you have Spain, who's fighting for France sometimes, and sometimes parts of it are not fighting for France. And then you have the Italian states, who are mostly just getting taken over by Napoleon at this point. You have places like Malta, who there's a whole thing going on there with who's going to own Malta and how are they going to make it work. And right in the middle of the First Barbary War is the Peace of Amiens, which is, a lot of historians mark that as when the Revolutionary Wars end and when the Napoleonic Wars begin, even though Napoleon's already on the scene before that. So there's this little break of a few months in the middle in 1802, 1803, and then they come back and they just start it right back up again. So that's kind of the geopolitical framework that this conflict with North Africa is placed in. So you have these four states across the top of North Africa, starting from the westernmost, you have Morocco, and then Algiers, Tunis, and Tripoli. And then even further to the east, you have Egypt. And that's actually where the European powers are mostly interested. We know, of course, that Napoleon has this sort of weird fascination with Egypt for whatever cultural reasons that he cares about Egypt. So the British and the French are very interested in Egypt, but they're also interested in the Barbary States, and they're interested in the Barbary States working on their behalf to be annoying to the other side. So when the United States goes to war with Tripoli, it's a complete sideshow to the main event, which is the Napoleonic Wars. And there's no getting around that. They have to be working all the time with most of their attention going to, what are the British and French doing that's going to cause us problems? Or how are we going to leverage this conflict in order to actually get what we want, which is ostensibly defeating Tripoli?
Abby, can you talk about the nature of Barbary piracy to this point? And I want to talk about that, particularly in the context of how the European states handled it, because one of the things that stands out here is that the U.S. doesn't handle it that way, and that's why we wind up with the war. So can you give people a little bit of context for that practice and how it was managed by the great powers that the U.S. Thinks itself to be a member of, but maybe is not just yet?
Yeah, absolutely. The first thing I'll say is something that I say every time I talk about this, which is that we're not actually talking about piracy here, because piracy is people who are doing their own thing without any reference to a state. That is not at all what is happening here. It is often termed piracy because the Europeans don't like it. And they see it as outside of their legal framework, which it is, but that doesn't make it piracy. That just makes it outside of a European legal framework. So essentially how this works, I like to call it an extortion racket. For centuries, by the time we get to 1801, the Barbary states have figured out that they are not going to ever be the big power in the Mediterranean, but that doesn't mean that they have no power, because they have the ability to move in and out of small areas in the Mediterranean and thus do bad things to people's trade, which is true. And so there is an ideological component here, which I want to emphasize what it is and what it isn't. Going back to the whole first brush with jihad thing, it does matter that these four states are Islamic. That does make a difference because they see themselves as being in opposition to the quote unquote Christian nations, and they do not behave toward each other like they behave toward the Europeans. But that does not mean that what they're going to do is strictly about religion or about ideology. It is about economy. It's about making money. Again, coming back to that, it's about making money. It's about establishing themselves with power. And it is only a little bit about religion, or at least it's not the only factor. So what they figure out that they can do is they're going to go attack commercial vessels that are trading in the Mediterranean anytime they're at war with a European nation. And this is where the legal framework comes in, because when we think about sort of the default status between nations, we assume that the default status is peace. But that's not how the Barbary states think about the default status between them and the Christian nations. They think about the default status as being war, unless there is a specifically signed peace treaty. So they're basically saying, we're at war with everyone, and we're going to take their ships, which is totally legal if you're at war. There's nothing illegal about it. And the only way you can get us to stop doing this is if you sign a peace treaty with us, and part of the peace treaty is going to be paying us a bunch of money. So it's a nice ship you've got there. Be a real bummer if anything happened to it, sort of situation. So this kind of treaty making was going on for centuries by this point.
Just have a very quick question related to that. I know in early Islamic law, we're doing a series on early Islam. There are different legal ways by which one treats, members of the Islamic community and people who are not. Is that what they're relying on here? And there's actually rules for how one does raids. There's like a legal context for that. And it's not just willy-nilly. And so
Yeah. So this is not a situation where they're just writing new ideas or new laws. They are actually following convention, even if it's not everything about this process is necessarily codified in Islamic law.
Of course.
It's not like, it's not piracy. They're not just being like, we're going to just take all the ships and we don't care. There actually is a system in place. So they realize that in order for this to work, they have to make money. And they make money in two different ways. Well, yeah, we'll say two different ways. One is that when they sign the peace treaty with these European nations, they demand tribute payments. That could be a one-off. That could be just a present that you give to the Barbary state or the Barbary ruler at the signing of the peace treaty. But depending on how powerful you are and how much they think they can leverage you, they might also make you pay annual tribute in perpetuity. So that's an annual source of income for these states. But the other way they're going to make money is when they capture ships. It's not like the Europeans capture ships in wartime. They take the ship. They probably sell it. They sell the cargo just like you would expect in a normal sort of European framework. But then they take the passengers and the crew into captivity. And this is not the kind of captivity where you like sit on your laurels in a jail cell until the war is over and then you go home. This is often hard labor. It's in extremely brutal conditions. And you're often working on the fortifications of the city that you're in, that you're captive in, or you're doing things that are really backbreaking labor. It's really bad. It's terrible. And that's going to go on until someone ransoms you. So this is how the Barbary states make money in a different way. They expect that people are going to get ransomed. And this does actually happen. Rich people pay off their own relatives' debt. people take up subscriptions to pay for a townsperson that they know who is in captivity so that they can, you know, everybody pools their money so that they can get people out of captivity, that kind of thing. But this is actually the more, in some ways, a more reliable source of income is these ransoms. So Barbary captivity is really scary for a lot of people because it feels different. It feels more oppressive. It certainly is very unhealthy. You're likely to get the plague or some other bad disease while you're being held in this dungeon and then doing backbreaking labor during the day. So it's really bad and nobody wants it. And so the Barbary states are counting on Europeans being willing to ransom people. And they do. They absolutely do. So everybody plays along with this system. And there's lots of reasons for that. Some of it is just it's easier than going to war a bunch of times. But also there's this sort of famous moment. I think it's Louis XIV, or maybe it's Louis XVI. I can't remember. It's one of the Louis. Says something like, if Algiers didn't exist, I would have to create it. Because what those nations are, what those states are doing is, yeah, okay, if you have to pay them off, that's fine, but so does your enemy. And if your enemy is not paying attention, then those Barbary states can actually be a thorn in the side of your enemy, just as well as they can be a thorn in your side. So as long as you're keeping up your end of the bargain, if you can disrupt your enemy's ability to pay the Barbary states or to ransom their captives or whatever, then you're actually giving yourself a second way of getting at your enemy, which the French and the British are very much interested in doing. So the Barbary system actually turns out to be quite sustainable for the Barbary states. Now, in terms of the United States, this is where it gets tricky.
Well, this is what I was going to ask. So the U.S. Becomes a player here after the revolution, and winds up going to war instead of just participating in the system. How much of the U.S. response to Barbary activity is because this new nation can't afford to treat it as a nuisance payment, which a lot of the European states did, or as a strategic investment? I think you talk at one point in early in the book that something like a fifth of an annual budget. I mean, this is like huge amounts of money for the United States government to shell out relative to the resources it has to deal with. And how much of it is because basically the early Americans like take offense at the way that they're being treated by the Barbary states for what reason you can sort of get into, but why, you know, there seems to be both of these things happening. One is just practically they can't afford it. They can't afford to make the payments. And two, there's some kind of like, how dare you, you know, treat us this way?
Yeah, it's absolutely both of those things. And I don't know if I can give you a percentage of how much of it is which one versus the other one. But yeah, it is worth noting that we often talk about this war as though it's like the United States decides they're going to do things differently, but actually they aren't. The whole time they're building a navy, they're also making treaties with each of the four Barbary states, and they are paying. So they actually are participating in the system as it is set up. The problem is, as you mentioned, it is very expensive. So we're talking about $1 million for Algiers, just for Algiers, which is a lot of money. And it is approximately 1/6 of the entire federal budget in the year 1795. Once you add on the treaties to the other three, we're talking about 1/5 of the number. Now, it's worth noting, and I say this in the book, we're not talking about that amount of money going out of the federal coffers every single year. That's a combined total, but some of that money gets paid out at different times. So it's not like they're paying a 1/5 of the federal budget every single year to the Barbary states. That's not what's happening. But it's not really sustainable, though. This is just a few years after the constitutional government has been formed. There's not a tremendous amount of federal revenue yet. And one of the best ways to get revenue for the federal government is via trade. In fact, that's one of the only ways that you get revenue into the federal government's coffers. So if you can't trade in this very lucrative trade area, the Mediterranean, well, then you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot. So that's the rationale here is it better to pay them off with the expectation that then that will allow you to have free access to the Mediterranean, which will then bring in more customs revenue, which will then allow you to pay off again, you know, like there's sort of a cycle here. And the other thing that's going on here is that, of course, when we think about Britain or France, we're talking about nations that have the military force ready at hand so that if they wanted to potentially go and take a crack at Algiers or whatever, they could do it. Now, they don't want to, remember, but they could. Like, the Mediterranean in this era is crawling with British naval vessels. Lord Nelson is hanging out there, but he's one of two different huge squadrons that are hanging out in the Mediterranean. So that's great. And if they want to go after one of these Barbary states, they could. And at least their presence is going to keep the Dey of Algiers, for instance, from making too many extra demands. That is not the situation for the United States. In 1785, which is the first year that the United States lost a ship to the Dey of Algiers, that's also the year that they sold off the last of their naval ships from the Continental Navy, from the Revolutionary Navy. So they have absolutely no navy whatsoever. And a lot of people in government think that's how it should be. So there's actually an ideological component here to whether or not the United States should even have a navy. They see the British Navy as being one of the agents of oppression that they had suffered under as colonial possessions of the British Empire. So they're very skittish. A lot of people are very skittish about the Navy. The one person who's not skittish about the Navy happens to be John Adams. So that's good when he becomes the president. But actually in 1794, things kind of come to a head with the Barbary States. And so the Naval Armament Act is signed, which authorizes the creation of a very small, essentially ad hoc navy. And they're going to build these six frigates, or they can buy them, but they end up building them. But the very last clause in the Naval Armament Act is, if peace is signed with Algiers, then this entire naval construction process goes away. Because people really don't want a navy. Congress doesn't really want a navy. So I always tell my students, so, like, what happened? Because you know already that I tell you that this Naval Armament Act is the founding of the U.S. Navy. So that means they didn't sign peace with Algiers, right? And they're like, yeah, right. No peace with Algiers. I'm like, no, wrong. They did sign peace with Algiers 1 year later in 1795. But by that point, relations with France had been deteriorating so much. And it seemed likely that the Barbary States were actually going to continue to cause problems because there was still Tunis and Tripoli to deal with at this point, that President Washington was convinced to allow the partial completion of these six frigates. So three of them were finished, and then the other three were finished under the Adams administration. So by the time we roll up to 1801, when Tripoli declares war on the United States has a very small navy. They are not going to chastise the insolence of anyone. They use that phrase a lot. They're going to chastise the insolence of these Barbary States. They're not. They don't have the power to do that, but they really want to. And they also, to get back to your point about, like, what's the calculus here between we don't have the money and we think you're all terrible. They really do see these European empires as being morally bankrupt, because they are willing to put up with this treatment from these non-Christian, non-white people. So there's a lot of racism in here. It's worth noting. They don't react to the French in the same way they react to the Barbary States, but they talk a lot about how morally bankrupt they think that all these Europeans are, because they just care only about the money and they don't care about the principle of fighting for their rights and free trade, and how dare they allow this to continue, and it's a good thing we've showed up now because we're going to stick it to the man, and all of these sort of grandiose pronouncements that, again, fly in the face of the material reality, which is that the United States still has an incredibly tiny navy and almost no power in the Mediterranean. But that does not stop them from thinking grand thoughts about how much better Republican ideology is, and thus how much more equipped they're going to be to take the fight to the Barbary States.
So along those lines, kind of expanding on that, talk about, your book gets into some of the, focuses on some of the major personages of the war from the U.S. perspective, the consuls, the, commanders of the naval expeditions, people like William Eaton, Edward Preble. And part of the reason for that is this was so removed from the United States or from any kind of, control back home. There are no bases even. There's nothing, time. These guys are on their own, basically, in a lot of ways. And they're trying to make policy effectively and to function in this environment where it's not easy to communicate and get instructions from back in the U.S. Can you talk a bit about how that kind of manifested, or how the war was carried out, and give people some background into some of these figures that you get into in the book?
Yeah, of course. So I want to first outline the major argument of the book, actually, which is that this war with Tripoli is only a little bit about defeating Tripoli. It's really about setting the United States up to be a part of the Mediterranean community. And what I mean by that is the United States recognizes that they need legitimacy as a nation. And one of the best ways to get legitimacy as a nation is to be treated like all the other nations and to be able to interact with all the other nations on the same level as anybody else. And so part of what they're doing when they're in the Mediterranean is trying to figure out how to navigate the defeat of Tripoli while also entering this community or trying to enter this community. And so a lot of times those two things conflict. So do you go and make a lot of brash demands of the Italian states when you actually really need them in order to defeat Tripoli? Or do you make the British be nice to you? How do you make them? You can't make them be nice to you. They're going to be nice to you with, if they feel like it. But you really need the British. And this is the material reality of the war, is that, again, from an ideological perspective, a lot of these Americans, they want to be part of the community, but they also have this like deep-seated belief that they're actually the best. So they're actually the top of the pile and nobody else thinks that. And so they have to tamp this down when they're dealing with the British, to whom they're entirely beholden, because there's, as you said, there's no bases for the U.S. in the Mediterranean. So they're really working out of British bases in Gibraltar and Malta, places like that. And so they have to be a part of this community in ways that are dictated by other members of the community. They have to just take it when the British treat them badly, because they need the British desperately. They have to just take it when the French decide to do all kinds of weird things, like shoot at them from an almost uninhabited island for no apparent reason. They have to figure out how to resolve that such that they don't end up alienating France, because they need France as well. And so each person that enters the Mediterranean as part of this conflict has to figure out for himself how he's going to negotiate these two ideas, how to put the United States on a good footing with all the nations of the Mediterranean, and how to defeat Tripoli, and how to do it without messing things up. The problem is nobody really knows how to do that. So each person has their own idea about how they're going to do that. And some of them have more well thought out or well defined ideas about how they're going to do that. And some of them have less. But what they don't have is a directive from back home that tells them exactly how this is supposed to be done. So the Navy guys, they have very vague orders from the Secretary of the Navy, which basically say, we don't really know what you're going to encounter when you get to the Mediterranean, so figure it out. Well, that's very helpful instructions. And it's fine if you are the kind of person who is good at seeing grand strategy, or if you're good at following all the moving pieces or whatever. It's not so fine if that's not your core skill. So let me illustrate this by talking about two of the Commodores. So there's four squadrons altogether, one right after another, starting in 1801 until 1805. First Commodore, I think he gets a bad rap. I think he did the best he could. You'll have to read the book to find out exactly what he did. But the second Commodore, Richard Valentine Morris, he is, let's say he's not an active, eager, aggressive person. And we know from the start that he did not expect for this to be an aggressive situation, because when he came to the Mediterranean on board the USS Chesapeake, his flagship, he brought with him his pregnant wife and his two-year-old son, Gerard. That's probably an indication that he did not expect to see a lot of action, because why would you bring your wife on board a vessel if you'd ever been in any kind of naval conflict before, which he had. He had been a part of battles in the Quasi War, so he knew what naval battles were like and that they're incredibly dangerous for every single person on board. So presumably, if you're going to bring your wife on board, you're not expecting to see a lot of action. And he came into a situation which perfectly illustrates what I'm talking about, which is that when he arrives in the Mediterranean, he realizes that there's actually a big problem with Morocco. And so his orders essentially say, go blockade Tripoli, but if there are other things that are going to allow you to keep the peace elsewhere, do that. And so he has to weigh whether he's going to go and be aggressive against Tripoli or whether he thinks it's more important to keep the peace with Morocco. And he ultimately decides that he needs to stay in Morocco, off of Morocco, in Tangier, to figure out this conflict with the Emperor of Morocco, which has to do with the capture of a ship and some tribute payments and stuff like that. And so he spends a good long while in Morocco trying to iron out this conflict. It doesn't actually get ironed out by him necessarily. It gets ironed out by the consul, James Simpson, the American consul in Tangier. But he's around and he thinks that it's important that there's a naval presence off of Morocco, because otherwise the Emperor of Morocco will essentially think that whatever Simpson says is toothless. And he's probably right about that. So he spends a ton of time off of Morocco. And the result of this is that he doesn't actually even get to Tripoli until a year into his tour. There's other reasons for that, though. It's not just that he chose Morocco, which I think was probably the right decision, but also that once Morocco was fixed, or at least a little bit fixed, he left Morocco and then he still didn't go to Tripoli. And this is where he gets into trouble. People start noticing that he's not actually doing anything against Tripoli, that he's mostly just hanging out in Malta. And he suggests later that it's because his ship was damaged and the weather was bad and he didn't have any backup. And all of those things are true, but they were just as true for every other Commodore as well as him. And somehow they figured out how to do it. So after all of this happens, he finally gets off of Tripoli and he spends an incredibly short amount of time off of Tripoli before he learns that he has actually been recalled to the United States to face a court-martial for dereliction of duty, because the Secretary of the Navy had heard reports that he was just doing nothing off Malta and going to some of the Italian states and stuff like that and not actually fighting against Tripoli. So he gets recalled and he gets court-martialed. He ultimately leaves the service because he is essentially convicted of dereliction of duty. His successor, Edward Preble, is the most famous of the Commodores. I'm sitting right now in a building that's right next to Preble Hall here on the campus of the United States Naval Academy. And he is Richard Valentine Morris's polar opposite in every possible way. He is eager. He is aggressive. He is a just a sailor through and through. He's from the state of Maine. It's not state yet. State of Massachusetts, the district of Maine. And he is just a bulldog. So when he shows up in Gibraltar, he learns that the situation with Morocco has not, in fact, been fixed. There are still problems with Morocco. So he is faced with exactly the same choice. Should he prioritize Morocco and establish these ties with the rest of the Mediterranean community, which includes the other Barbary states besides Tripoli, or should he go after Tripoli? And he decides he's going to do both. So he stays in Morocco for a little while, but he sends a ship to Tripoli and he says something to the effect of, I'm doing this so that the Bashar of Tripoli doesn't think that we've forgotten about him, because we haven't and we're coming for him. So he dispenses with the Moroccan situation in a fairly short amount of time, and then he's off to Tripoli. And he decides not only is he going to blockade the port, which is what everybody's been doing up to this point, but he is going to bombard the port of Tripoli. And so he actually introduces a whole new strategy and spends the entire summer of 1804 preparing for the bombardment of Tripoli, which he starts in August. And then he spends about 6 weeks bombarding the port of Tripoli. So he decides in the calculus between entrance into the Mediterranean community and the defeat of Tripoli that he is actually going to prioritize defeating Tripoli. So that's just kind of an illustration of how these two things can go differently with people who have almost exactly the same orders and a pretty similar force that they're working with. Sorry, that was really long.
No, that's great. I think, I mean, we're sort of approaching an endpoint. And I guess just to give people a flavor of how the war went, the part of the reason that I really like the First Barbary War is because the most famous event is essentially the blowing up of a U.S. ship. And from the perspective of the U.S., this is the mission that defined the Navy. It created the one of the first military heroes in U.S. history, Stephen Decatur. And it really is sailing into Tripoli Harbor and blowing up a U.S. ship. But can you, without going into too much detail and you know, kind of spoiling the book, but can you just give people kind of the bird's eye view of how this war went, and maybe you know, a little bit of talk about the Philadelphia and the Battle of Derna, which was supposed to settle the war, only to have the U.S., contrary to the image of the U.S. as kind of standing up to the awful jihadists, wound up paying ransom for its prisoners and settling the war that way.
No, you're totally right that I think there's two, if anybody knows anything about the First Barbary War, they know about two things. And those are the things that you just mentioned, the burning of the Philadelphia and then the march across the quote unquote shores of Tripoli, which is in the first line of the Marine hymn. Again, around here, I'm surrounded by U.S. Marines, so this comes up a lot. But so the Philadelphia is actually a part of Edward Preble's squadron. So the guy that I was just talking about, it is sort of the advance guard of that squadron, and it goes, essentially, that's the ship that gets sent to Tripoli to say, we're coming for you. And so what it's doing in October of 1803 is it's doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing. It's blockading the port of Tripoli, and it's doing it in conjunction with a smaller ship, and it loses track of the smaller ship. And then by a sort of freakish accident slash bad charts, it's chasing a little boat into Tripoli Harbor, and it runs aground on October 31st, 1803. So this is the second largest ship in the squadron behind the Constitution, which is Preble's flagship. And the captain, William Bainbridge, decides after assessing the situation that there's no possible way that they can come out of this and get off the reef or get away. And so he essentially surrenders the ship without much fighting at all. So all of the people on board are taken into captivity. They're treated as prisoners of war and not as those like normal captives that we were talking about necessarily, but they're still in Barbary captivity. The officers are treated way better than the enlisted sailors, which is just kind of how it went back in the day. But So William Bainbridge and his entire crew are taken into captivity. That's really bad, because whatever leverage the United States or whatever momentum the United States had at that point, it's lost. You can't come back from that, because now the Bashar of Tripoli has a huge bargaining chip, which is your actual people, members of your military, sitting in prison, and he can keep them forever. So, of course, this changes how the war goes. And Preble, this is really the moment when Preble decides Tripoli has to be it. We have to take care of Tripoli, and Morocco, we're just going to have to trust that we've figured this out enough. So he comes to Tripoli and he does more blockading, but he also starts to figure out, like, what are we going to do about this situation? Adding insult to injury, just a couple days after the capture, the tide shifts enough that the Philadelphia is able to be lifted off of the reef. And then the Tripolitans have not only over 300 American captives, but now they have a very lovely, large U.S. frigate with everything intact. That's not great if you're trying to, you know, wage a naval war and you just handed over your biggest ship or one of your biggest ships. So Preble realizes that aside from negotiation, there's no way to get the prisoners free. That's, or, you know, taking the city of Tripoli, which is not really something that can be done, at least not in 1803. But he's like, okay, at least we can get rid of the ship. So in January of 1804, he and a young lieutenant named Stephen Decatur, and in conjunction with William Bainbridge, who's writing to them from captivity, sometimes in invisible ink, actually, they hatch this plan to sail a little tiny ship that they've captured, which they named the Intrepid, into Tripoli Harbor in the middle of the night. And they're going to take a crew of about 70 men who are going to board the Philadelphia and set explosive charges all over her, and then they're going to blow her up. So Stephen Decatur, the young lieutenant, is tapped to be the leader of this expedition, and he takes his 70 sailors with him, and they go and they execute the mission on February 16th, 1804. And it works perfectly, like not a hitch. It all goes off exactly as intended. And so, yeah, it's a pretty big deal. People are like, whoa, they just burned their entire ship. That's crazy. There's an apocryphal quote from Lord Nelson about it being the most bold and daring act of the age.
That's right. I forgot about
that. I don't think he ever said that.
probably not.
But, you know, Lord Nelson, he just said some stuff like that sometimes. So maybe he did. I don't know. But we don't have any actual evidence that he ever said that. But it's a nice saying. And actually, it is the motto of the USS Decatur right now. Their motto is bold and daring after Lord Nelson's apocryphal quote.
So, that's perfect. We should just stop there. That's
I know, right?
Gets you right here.
But that's great. You know, like, good job. You did it. It works out great for Stephen Decatur. He becomes the youngest captain ever in the history of the Navy, and that's still true even today. So he was 25 when he got his captaincy. And that's awesome. But here's the thing. When you do that, what do you get? You get nothing. You gained nothing from doing that, except for that the Tripolitans could not sail this ship, which they didn't know how to sail anyway. So all you get is a moral victory. Like, yeah, it was awesome. And people like gave Stephen Decatur swords and stuff, but you don't get anything out of it. So the problem of defeating Tripoli is just as acute as it was before. Well, enter William Eaton, who we have not yet talked about, but he is a real character. He was the consul to Tunis, and he stopped being the consul to Tunis in 1803 because he had a new plan, which he'd been working on since 1801. And his plan was to go about this defeat of Tripoli in a different way. Preble wanted to bombard the city into negotiating, and Eaton was like, okay, but what if we just do regime change? Let's try that. So the ruler of Tripoli, Yusuf Karamanli, had an older brother whose name was Hamet. And Hamet had worked together with Yusuf to enact some regime change of his own in the 1790s. But then Yusuf kicked him to the curb, basically, and sent him into exile. And he had kind of been a few different places, but somehow William Eaton and his counterpart, the erstwhile consul to Tripoli, James Leander Cathcart, had found out that Hamet existed, and they thought, huh, what if we brought Hamet and put him on the throne of Tripoli? And then he'd be so grateful to us that he would negotiate a better treaty, and maybe we would never have to pay any money to Tripoli ever again. This sounded like a great idea, except for the United States does not know how to do regime change. And also, everybody told them, Hamet is not leadership material. He is flaky. He will not do what he says. He's very lazy. He's never going to do the things that you want him to do. And they're like, nope, don't care. We're going to do it anyway. So it took Eaton the better part of 3.5 years to finally get one of the Commodores to agree to support this mission. He realized that he couldn't do it without naval support. And so he started the wheels moving in 1801, but really didn't get them fully engaged until late 1804. So finally, in January of 1805, the moment comes. Hamet is living in Alexandria, Egypt. Eaton's going to go find him. He's going to build a fighting force. They are going to march across the desert, and they're going to force Yusuf out, and Hamet's going to get seated on the throne. That's what Eaton says, anyway. And kind of miraculously, in Alexandria, he's able to pull together this motley crew of people who are actually going to support this mission. So he's got a small U.S. naval vessel that's kind of running interference for him, and he's going to meet him down the road with supplies and stuff. But he's got Hamet's retinue, which is like 90 people, and he's got this company of cannoneers who are just mercenaries. He's got some Greek mercenaries, and then he's got a bunch of Bedouin horse warriors who are all going to join this party. And there's about 400 of them when they leave Alexandria. They're going to march 500 miles across the desert of North Africa to get to Derna, which is a city in Tripoli, in the region of Tripoli, which actually Hamet had been the ruler of for a hot minute in about 1802. And they're going to take Derna, and then from there, they're going to go on to Tripoli, which is another 500 miles. Eden's like, this is totally going to work. We've got it. And
what could go wrong?
What could go wrong? Well, it turns out a lot can go wrong because, you know, you have to like feed people and make sure they have water and stuff like that. And also, none of these people is working for the love of the game. They're working for money. And Eaton doesn't actually have a whole lot of money. In fact, he's basically exhausted the ready money that he has almost before they even leave Alexandria. So he has to keep promising them money over and over and over and over and over again. And sometimes they're like, we don't believe you. We don't think there is any money. And Eaton, of course, is probably thinking in his mind, well, you got me. There is actually no money. But he keeps promising them, and they threaten to mutiny a lot along this journey. And sometimes they do actually even mutiny. But astonishingly, despite the fact that it was just one thing after another, they actually make it to Derna. And they do it in about 6 weeks. They arrive there at the end of April in 1805. And even more astonishingly, with the help of two small U.S. naval vessels off the port, who start bombarding the port, they take the city of Derna in 2 hours. And it's like the best possible outcome William Eaton could ever have imagined for this. So, of course, the group I failed to mention is the one that we all really care about, which is amongst this motley crew, which by the time they get to Derna is over 1,000 people. Amongst this motley crew, there are two naval officers, there is one Marine lieutenant whose name is Presley O'Bannon, and there are 7 enlisted Marines. Yes, you heard me right. That is 7 out of a force of over 1,000. If you believe the U.S. Marine mythology, you will learn that those 7 Marines did all the work in the capturing of Derna, and everybody else just came in from behind after the Marines had taken the city. Okay, sure. You can believe that if you want. I'm pretty sure that's not how it went down, but that is how Presley O'Bannon basically says it went down. So, you know, We'll just go with his version. But
it's a better story.
It's a better story. So the Marines led the charge and Presley O'Bannon held everybody together and it was all good. So, of course, the next step for Eaton is going to Tripoli. Only he has already realized by this point that what everybody said about Hammett is true. That Hammett cannot be left to his own devices. That somebody is going to have a strong hand with him or he's going to buckle. And so Eaton is kind of thinking, oh man, we are in trouble because I'm going to have to stick around and like make sure that Hammett can actually do this thing. Meanwhile, Yusuf, the brother who's actually ruling Tripoli, has realized that this is going to be a real pain in his ass. So he decides the best way to deal with this situation is not to fight against Hammett, it's to make peace with the Americans. So he, after having stonewalled the American negotiator for quite a long time, finally says, okay, let's talk. And so the Americans, who are separate from this expedition, start negotiating with Yusuf Karamanli. And so by the time Eaton has taken the city of Derna, negotiations are imminent. So Eaton has told Hammett all these things about how he's going to put him on the throne and how they're going to make this treaty, et cetera, et cetera. And the actual official U.S. position is not that. So they have negotiated with Yusuf and have come up with a way to make everybody at least okay. Maybe not happy, but at least okay. And so in June of 1805, the United States signs a peace treaty with Yusuf Karamanli, which means Hammett is kind of out in the cold here. And Eaton thinks that this is the worst thing that the U.S. could possibly have done, that they have left their ally out in the cold, that they have gone back on their agreement with him and all of these bad things. And he's furious, just like absolutely livid. But the important thing to remember here about this story is that Eaton told Hammett things that he was explicitly told by Samuel Barron, the Commodore, not to tell him. Barron emphasized over and over and over again to Eaton, yes, we're going to give you naval support for this operation, but do not tell Hammett that we are definitely going to put him on the throne, because I cannot make that kind of guarantee. We are going to go with Hammett as long as it is useful, and then we will do whatever needs to be done. But do not tell Hammett definitively that we are going to put him on the throne, because we are not going to do that. But Eaton did tell him that they were going to put him on the throne. And so he had built up this idea in his mind that this is how it was going to be, because he decided that that's how it was going to be, when everybody else said, don't overpromise. So Eden's furious about this for the rest of his life. And it's not the best look for American diplomacy, let's put it that way, to sort of just, now the U.S. is kicking Hammett to the curb. Essentially, he goes back into exile. I mean, he doesn't get killed, which is something I think that certainly could have been an outcome. Like, you know, twice burned by your brother. I mean, it feels like
part and parcel of having these guys just kind of freelancing their way through this.
Absolutely. So this is a perfect illustration.
And the government is doing the other. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a perfect illustration of this idea where he got so little official guidance that he sort of felt like whatever he said went. But this is one case where he did get extremely clear and specific guidance, which he decided to ignore. So that's kind of on him. But yeah, so this is the end of the war, is the treaty that they negotiate with Yusuf. It is, all things considered, not too bad. So there's no tribute going forward, although I will observe that there was no annual tribute anyway in their original treaty. And they do have to pay Tripoli, but what they're paying for is not tribute. It's not that sort of obligatory payment. They're actually ransoming the prisoners from the USS Philadelphia. And it ends up being $60,000, which accounts for about 200 of them. And then the other 100 were a prisoner exchange. So all things considered, is not too bad. But it's not exactly what they were hoping for either. It certainly is not the great and crushing victory that everybody was sort of talking about was going to happen.
So I've already kept you too long. I apologize for that. But it's okay. I do want just briefly, to kind of round this out. How does this very messy conclusion to a war where the big event was burning one of the U.S. own frigates and the final outcome was paying ransom for U.S. captives. How does this turn into the glorious victory and the birth of the U.S. as a military power and, you know, the shores of Tripoli line and the Marines hymn? Like, where does that develop out of? It just give people an overview of that.
That's a great question that I don't know that I have a really great answer for, except for to say that there is some characters in this story who were really good at mythologizing. And one of those people is Stephen Decatur. So Stephen Decatur has this cachet because he is the youngest captain ever. He does this glorious thing. And then he becomes the captain of the USS Constitution. And then he sort of spectacularly gets killed in a duel in 1820. So he's like this larger than life figure. And so I think there's a sense in which you kind of don't want his big moment to have been in vain or been for nothing. And so you have to start crafting a story where, like, okay, when he burnt the Philadelphia, that really mattered. That was really important. And then as a sort of origin story for the Navy, as I said, the Naval Armament Act, which was signed in 1794, was explicitly about the Barbary States. So there's this sense that, like, this is where the Navy came from. This is like the birth of the Navy. So I think that's part of it. And then I think there really is a significant part of this that's about racism or anti-Muslim sentiment, particularly, as I said, you know, since 9/11, that's certainly true. But even before that, there's a strong sense of, you know, Christian obligation or a Christian sense of rightness or justice or whatever. And this war kind of is easy to pigeonhole into that, like, well, look how good we were. And then, of course, the Marines. I think the Marines were looking for a story that connected them to their past that was prior to the 20th century. So when they start writing about what their origin story is, will they also say that they were founded in 1775 or something like that? Because, you know, they all were technically. But then if you want to really go to like the big moments like Belleau Wood, well, that's in World War I. So if you've got a service that started in 1775, well, you need some waypoints along the way. And so you end up with these two waypoints in the hymn, which are this war and then a battle in the Mexican-American War. And so the Marines are the best in the world at mythologizing. So they'll grab anything they can to help tell their story, which unifies the force. So I think they were just looking for, you know, some good Marine action where Marines were fighting and, you know, all that stuff. I don't know. There's good books about the Marines self-mythologizing, but yeah.
So I did say, as a final question, you can just talk for a couple of minutes about this, but I did say we would get back to the board game. Right. What was that like doing the board game and just, you know, give people a sense of that? I don't think we've had, to my knowledge, anybody who's done a board game or contributed to a board game on the show before. So I'm curious.
No, it was really fun, actually. So I was actually approached by the creator of the board game, Kevin Bertram, who is the owner of Fort Circle Games. It's been a while now. Like, I can't remember when it came out, actually. But he had read the book that I referenced at the beginning, Brian Kilmeade's Thomas Jefferson and the Tripoli Pirates. And he'd gotten really interested in the conflict. But then he had somehow found out about my work and he asked me if I wanted to play test the game because he'd used Kilmeade's book, but then he'd also gone and like looked for other sources and he'd found stuff that I'd written online and he'd found, I can't remember, maybe he even found my dissertation. And so he kind of wanted me to bring my expertise to the gameplay to see if the cards made sense or if the strategy that you enact when you play the game was at least kind of vaguely close to how it was really thought about. So that was really fun. And then I did that with him. And then I ended up writing sort of like a history essay, I guess, that goes in the box. So you get that when you buy the game. There's a little essay by me in there. And it's been really fun, actually, to see people playing it and to talk to people who are interested in board games. And this is their first introduction to the First Barbary War. and talk to them. And I will say he did a really, really fantastic job of grappling with the complexity of the war and making sure that it was about more than just operations. So there's cards in there that really, they do complicate the gameplay in a way that I think absolutely represents the historical reality. So it's really fun. They're coming out with a second printing in a little while here, which will have a revised edition of my essay and some primary source documents and stuff. So, yeah. And he has, that was his first board game he ever made, but he actually has the company Fort Circle Games is now on its like maybe fourth or fifth historical board game. And they're all really great. So he did one about women's suffrage. He's doing one about the Mexican-American War, because of course, if you had the shores of Tripoli, you have to have the halls of Montezuma. And then he's doing one about Blackbeard or pirates. And I can't remember, but there's a couple more in the hopper. So yeah, it's a really, really
great
company. And the games are really well made and nice to play. So yeah, shout out to Four Circle.
Awesome.
Anytime you have a chance to grab one of those, you should do it.
All right. Well, we'll try to get a link to that in the show description. Of course, awesome. We'll have a link for people to check out your book. And if you haven't, if you're interested at all in early American history or, fighting the jihadists, by all means, this is a great
this
book.
This is not the book for you if you want to fight the jihadists.
No, well, yeah, okay. Maybe not if you're really intent on the jihadist thing. But it really great. The book is To Fix a National Character, The United States in the First Barbary War, 1800 to 1805. Abby Mullen, thank you again so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.